Guardian Unlimited.
What has inspired you to write about Thomas Paine, and why now?
Well, I've been writing about Paine all my life, so when I was asked, I suppose it was because I've written a lot about him that I was asked to do this. But it's more about the book than the man. You know, the series is about books that change the world. So it's about the rights of man rather than Paine, but of course one has to tell his story as well. And I think, well, there's no bad time to discuss it, the rights of man. But at present, arguments over human rights are very intense, and, you know, what they mean and how extensive they are. Probably more than usual. And then there's an occasion to discuss the meaning of the American Revolution. And probably that's a hotter topic now than it has been for some time.
And is the backlash against a high-profile figure such as yourself who writes an academic book, is that inevitable, do you think? And are you anticipating one?
Backlash?
I mean, for instance, Martin Amis wrote about Stalin, and the reviews were, I mean, the academic community thought it was invading their turf rather than, if you see what I mean.
I remember some reviews that were like that, yes, particularly Orlando Fige's, but I had my own differences with that book. it wasn't just that it was invading academic turf, it was that it wasn't invading academic turf enough. In other words, it wasn't really historical. The thing about Paine is precisely in a way that he's been neglected by the academics, except for Professor John Keane, who did an excellent biography of him a few years ago. The field of Paine studies is sort of oddly open, because he belongs not to the academic world at all, but to the sort of hidden history, people's history tradition. And, you know, there's no memorial to him, really, in either Britain or America. I don't know about France. I don't think there is a major one there either, and yet he was an enormous participant in great events in all three places.
And how do you think Paine, a staunch advocate of human rights, as you say, would view his influence today? And what do you think he would make of, say, the American prison at Guantanamo Bay?
Oh, well, I don't play that game at all, because I think that after a certain lapse of time, it's futile. I mean, when I wrote my book about Orwell, people said, well, what would he have said about this or that? And I believe it's possible to guess from his actual writing and experience and opinion what he would have said about the invasion of Suez, which took place only a few years after he died, or the French and then the American attempt to hold on to Vietnam, because we know enough about what he thought about that, those things to make an informed surmise. But I don't think one can say anything about his opinion much after 1984 itself. It's just not possible to do it. However, if you really want me to speculate, I mean, I shouldn't duck your question. The fact is that when he was living in France, there was a time when, even after Bonaparte had more or less put an end to the French Revolution, but they were still fighting the British, where Paine, I criticized him for it in the book, actually, more or less agreed that they had the right to take repressive measures in France to forestall a British conspiracy to overthrow the regime. And for a while, he made excuses for, you know, authoritarian measures. It's the only time in his life I know that he did that.
Sure.
But so it would depend really on what he thought of the cause, I suppose, as always it does.
Well, moving away from the book, your recent essays have been more concerning Iran, and having supported the attack on Iraq, you're taking a different...
It wasn't an attack on Iraq.
It wasn't?
No. It was an intervention in Iraq. Okay. It was an attack on Saddam Hussein, not,
sure,
not Iraq.
Sure. Well, assuming that, you suggest a different attack in Iran. What's the essential difference in the two cases, do you think?
There are two. One is we know fairly well what the internal politics of Iran are like, which was impossible to guess with exactitude with Iraq. In Iraq, you know, it was death to possess a satellite dish, for example, and the Iraqi people had very little means of communicating their opinions to the outside world. We had a rough idea, but it was much more approximate than in the Iranian case, where we know that there is a very large pro-Western public opinion that wants to have a constitutional democracy instead of a theocratic state. And we're in touch with a lot of these people. So that's one thing. And thus one could hope for Iran to evolve slowly, because even though their elections are phony, they do actually have elections. They have the concept of them. and it's nothing like as terrifying and irrational a dictatorship as was that of Saddam Hussein. That's the first thing. The second is, there are many people who welcome the end of the theocracy. There are not very many who would welcome a military intervention. So an intervention risks losing one of the greatest assets we have, which is a friendship with the majority segment of the Iranian people. And the second thing is that though Iran is certainly in breach of all its obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and with the UN and the IAEA and so forth, it has not, like Iraq, invaded other countries, hasn't committed genocide as Saddam Hussein had done and was prepared to do again. It hasn't put itself as much outside international law as the Ba'athists had done. And I might add a third condition, which is that the mullahs are very nasty and their ideology is somewhat deranged. I mean, it's based on a messianic version of Shiism. It isn't actually demented. It's not clinically insane in the way that Saddam Hussein was. So there are a number of ways of facing the problem that the mullahs and the combination of mullahs and nukes present to us.
I don't know if you'd think it was fair to say, you often identify most with writers throughout history who have attacked the status quo in their own countries, Zola, Paine himself. And as an adopted American and a sworn atheist, does the power of the Christian right trouble you?
Well, the power of the Christian right, I think, is overstated because it provides good copy, because it's led by these bizarre characters like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who are endlessly interesting because of their stupidity and their greed, and who both of whom, by the way, said that they thought that the attacks on civil society in America on 9/11 were God's punishment for things like homosexuality and divorce. So, which puts them in a very tiny minority where they belong. I've been living in the United States nearly a quarter of a century now, and I remember everyone used to think that they ran Ronald Reagan's administration. Well, they didn't. Nor did they run George Bush the First's administration. They've never succeeded in getting any of the things they want, like a ban on abortion or prayer in schools, returned, and they never will. The United States is much too big to be governed by any one faction, and certainly won't ever be governed by them. So, and there's a stupid tendency on the part of some people to equate that with Islamic theocratic terrorism, and it's just nothing like that. But no, what depresses me is not the Christian right, it's Christianity. Is the privilege given to religion, not just in the United States, but in other countries too, the feeling that, you know, a bishop has more to say on moral questions than anyone else is, you know, an assumption quite widely shared. It's the symbiosis between the different messianisms, the Christians who encourage the Israeli messianic settlers, for example. Those messianic settlers help confirm the Palestinian fundamentalists and their allies in other countries, all of them really hoping for what they all secretly share and have in common, which is the end of the world.
You were one of Bill Clinton's most fierce critics. If his wife stands as expected for president, can she expect the same treatment?
Well, not if she continues to be solid on the main point, which she is. I mean, I'm a single-issue voter, and she is the only one of the senior Democrats who takes a firm line on the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, I mean, and against Islamic nihilism in general. So she's made so many speeches about it and taken so many stern positions, partly, I think, because of the knowledge that she acquired when she was in the Clinton administration, which had to deal a lot with Iraq and which failed to deal with Al-Qaeda. So I think she may even mean what she says. But the point is, I think she can be held to these positions, and I don't think she can easily disown them, even though there are a lot of people on the move on left who wish that she would. So, you know, if she was the nominee, or if she was the campaigning for the nomination, I'd be for her on those conditions. Though I personally prefer John Edwards, who is a nice man, and in politics for good reasons, and isn't someone who's in politics for therapy, as she largely is. But alas, he who took quite a firm line on the war has caved in a bit to the so-called anti-war, actually pro-war movement.
I mean, there was those who were suggesting you were backing Bush at the last election.
No, I was in favour of Bush at the last election.
But you're willing to switch to...
Well, no, I mean, if the Republicans picked Giuliani, I would much prefer him, because I think he would be much more trustworthy on it. But if there's to be a Democrat, let's say I'd support her for the nomination on this basis, and then I have to see who the Republicans came up with. They might come up with someone who's soft on the war. It's quite possible. The Republican Party itself is quite soft on the war, and not very good at prosecuting it either.
And inevitable George Galloway question. Have you followed his recent progress, particularly that of his Big Brother appearance in the UK?
I was very shocked to get the huge number of emails from people who, of course, you know, thought it would please me at the hideous spectacle he made of himself on that. And of course, it was gratifying to see him, you know, emerge as the sort of Yob and Burke and general thug and psycho that he is. But it nettled me was that he got far more condemnation for that than he did from being a pimp for Saddam Hussein and Bashar al-Assad. People, a lot of people said this is the worst thing he's ever done. No, it isn't. He's both a pimp for and a prostitute of totalitarian dictatorship and terrorist movements. I mean, and it seems to me extraordinary that after the report of the Senate Investigations Committee and of the Paul Volcker's report from the UN, both of them on the Oil for Food program, and both of them independently showing his role in that, that he hasn't been removed from the House of Commons, because he lied about this, these earnings and these connections, or rather did not disclose them in his register of interests. And I had a feeling that that meant you were out, or at least you were censured. So it seems to me absolutely appalling that the man is still in politics. But I can say with some gratification that the last five times that anyone has proposed a debate of any kind between us, he said no. That, in a small way, pleases me.
Okay, and very lastly, you're appearing at the Guardian's Hay Festival next week. Is that something you look forward to? I know you appeared last year with your brother.
I've only missed Hay, I think, once in the last 7 years. I just couldn't make it 1 year. I think of it as one of the absolute dates in my calendar every year. It's wonderful, and getting better, too. And I think it's great that The Guardian does this.